Moya presents Class of 79.
He thinks that I'm turning into my mother. Day by day, moment by moment, he thinks that I'm trying to make Candy into baby Nola.
Is he right?
No. That's the last thing on earth. Who's that?
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 79 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turn 40 this year. I'm Natasha Pacetta, your host and vanguard of The Vault over here at Fangoria, and this is our series on David Cronenberg's The Brood. Our guest today is cinematographer Mark Irwin. Mark has brought some of our favorite movies from all genres to life. He was the director of photography on There's Something About Mary, 10 Things I Hate About You, Road Trip, Old School, Scream, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, but he got his start working with David Cronenberg. Mark was the man behind the camera on Videodrome, Scanners, The Fly, and The Brood. Before we get to Mark's stories, I want to tell you about the new Fangoria.com. Fangoria.com is now live and brimming with the digital horror content you crave. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. They're taking the time to aggregate the most important news in horror in one space to save you time and sanity. You'll also find long-form pieces, deep dives, and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Right now, all current subscribers to the magazine are automatically members of Fangoria.com, and as promised, the content of the new issues will forever be print only. If you're not already a subscriber, check out the new Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use promo code CLASSOF for 15% off right now. And I want to tell you about the Nick Taylor Horror Show. If you're a horror director or an aspiring horror director, this is the podcast for you. The Nick Taylor Horror Show podcast is your go-to masterclass in horror filmmaking, featuring interviews with guests like Joe Dante, Mick Garris, Roger Corman, Tom Holland, Bill Moseley, and Mitzi Perone. Each episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show explores and deconstructs the success strategies of established horror directors while summarizing the key insights and resources that you can use on your own horror filmmaking journey. This includes their creative processes, strategies for getting their films off the ground, favorite books and tools, key life lessons, and much more. Download and subscribe to the Nick Taylor Horror Show today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere you listen, or visit nicktaylor.com for more information. Now let's get to Mark's stories from the making of The Brood. So Mark, you've done horror movies, you've shot The Blob remake, which is one of the greatest remakes of all time, I think. Fright Night Part 2.
You really
two.
Think so?
Oh, my gosh.
I'm glad you say that. Yeah, I reconnected with Chuck Russell, the director,
yes,
on a film last year that we shot in Thailand and India, all about elephant smuggling. It was not a horror film.
Oh.
But that, you know, he did The Mask and Scorpion King. He's done a lot of things that aren't horror related, so... Yeah, we can all break the rules, but Chuck is still out there, and The Blob, that was one of the first movies I did when I moved to California.
Oh, wow.
Way
yeah.
back when.
It is seriously, I think, one of the best horror remakes of all time. It is so good. It looks so good. The practical effects are just right up there with some of the best. And when I saw that on your credits, I was like, man, you know, this guy has shot all of my, you know, favorite horror movies, like Fright Night Part 2, which is incredible. Wes Craven's New Nightmare, Scream. And outside of the horror genre, you've done so many amazing comedies. You've done Dumb and Dumber, There's Something About Mary, like Old School, 10 Things I Hate About You. These are like loved movies. And you span genres, which is so amazing and a testament to just your skill with the camera. But this is, of course, a podcast about The Brood, David Cronenberg's
yeah.
The Brood. And you started early on in your career working with David. Can you kind of tell the audience how you guys met? What was the first movie you worked on? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, ironically, David and I met to do a film, or conceivably, the producer was producing a film in the genre, in the style of Sam Arkoff, AIP Productions. I had done a film with this producer a year earlier called Blood and Guts, which, you know, was a very subtle title. It was about wrestling. And it was that kind of a movie, just blood and guts, you know, a wrestling troupe on the road. So a year later, he wanted to do a film. This was now 1978, wanted to do a film about drag racing, set in Montana and shot in the province of Alberta, in an area around Edmonton, Alberta, which is in northern Alberta. And the director they chose was someone who had experience in racing, actually racing cars, and that was David Cronenberg. And I had studied David's films, his independent films, as well as his commercial films. He did two films that most people don't know about or haven't seen, Stereo and Crimes of the Future. And for a young English-Canadian filmmaker, and I have to make that distinction because the French-Canadians were on a different tangent, shall we say. They were much more successful in their, literally in their world, because they had a captive audience that spoke only French. They made movies in French. I had started watching all the National Film Board films I could find, and my heroes were all French-Canadian filmmakers and cameramen. And when David came along, it was like another, this guy's from Toronto. I'm from Toronto. He's making great movies. I'm going to study them. So I studied all his films, wrote a thesis at York University, where I graduated in 73. And 5 years later, I get to meet David, who at that point had chosen another cameraman, René Verdier, who was not French Canadian, but French from Paris. He was ready to do this film in Edmonton. So I met David along with Peter O'Brien, who was the producer, who'd done Blood and Guts. Now he was doing a drag racing movie. And David's experience in racing cars was an English vintage motor cars, Austin Healey's and Minis and things like that. So it was a bit of a stretch to say he's the man to shoot a drag racing movie, which is, from an automotive standpoint, very different. Nonetheless, I met David, and he said, with a kind of noncommittal handshake, "Yeah, how you doing?" And that was that. I wasn't in the running to get the gig, so I looked elsewhere. But I got a call later, which is to say 2 months later, that brought me to Edmonton. It seems that René Verdier had decided that the summer in Edmonton was not the same as the summer in Paris, and he left them on a Thursday to go back to Paris. They had no cameraman. The producer said, call this guy Mark Irwin. So I got a call at midnight in Toronto saying, "Hey, Mark, how's it going? What's happening? Who is this?" "David." "David who?" I was half asleep. "You know, David Cronenberg. We're doing it." So to make a long story short, I got on a plane the next morning, or that same morning, because it was past midnight, and ended up shooting Fast Company. Wow. That was in the summer of 1978, and David, back to his roots, had another film that he'd written about his life experience with his ex-wife and his daughter, and had put together financing. So two months later, we wrapped that show in Edmonton, a drag racing movie, in September. In October, we were prepping The Brood, and in November and December we shot it in Toronto.
Wow.
So I'd only done one film with David, which was not a horror style, but I had studied his work so well that by the time the first week of shooting on Fast Company, he said, "Well, you seem to know my style pretty well. I really like what you're doing." I didn't want to tell him, "I've been shadowing you my whole life." But anyway, that was our secret. I guess the secret's out now.
Wow. Well, isn't that a lesson on being prepared? You know, you were prepared for the opportunity. And once it happened, you know, which was very fortuitous, you know, you get called because this guy falls out. And then from that moment on, then you're doing a second movie with David Cronenberg. And then you go on to do four other movies with David Cronenberg: Scanners, Videodrome, The Dead Zone, The Fly.
Yeah.
So amazing. Talk a little bit about your relationship with David on set. How did you guys work together?
Well, David, as I learned and was admired him so much, the early films that he had done, Stereo and Crimes of the Future, and I urge your podcast listeners to find them online. These were films that he wrote and directed and shot. Mm-hmm. And as a young graduate of University of Toronto, talking about David, this was not something that he studied. I'd gone to film school to be a cameraman, and I was just blown away that he had such a strong visual style when he'd never had any training. So it was my relationship with him was very conspiratorial. The Brood had enough shadow in it, enough mystery, and I don't want to say it, but a brooding quality, and it was part of the back was the, what was in my back pocket when we opened at the Psychoplasmic Institute. It wasn't a chance to let's be bright and cheerful and see the world. There was all these levels of mystery. When Nuala Fitzgerald, the mother, is killed in her house, doesn't happen in the dark of night. It's a sunny day with the sun coming in the windows.
Right.
So the things that go bump in the night are scary. Death in broad daylight is also scary. And David was one not to say, well, let's follow the rules. This is how, you know, Hitchcock did it, or Kubrick, or Vincent Price would be in a scene like this. It would be dark and scary. He wasn't afraid to say, let's just make it happen and let it travel from there. So it came to lighting and setting shots. He was very specific and very, very open. I think we were both learning our collective style as well as individual style together, and to apply the ability to frame and block and light and shoot a scene. People forget, certainly people listening to a podcast, they're thinking of the finished film. Making the film is a series of days that you have to make. Right. So you're given 12 hours, and sometimes those 12 hours don't include the sun being up all 12 hours. Sometimes the sun goes down and you have to still keep shooting outside as if it was daytime. So part of my learning and training that both David and I had in the early days of the film business, the film boom in Canada, was that the investments from the tax write-off contributors, which were in the early days, like when The Brood, these guys were people who own a string of dentist offices or chiropractic offices,
right,
or were car dealers, and they would invest in the fourth quarter, which meant October, November, and December. That was when we were shooting, which meant the sun in Toronto, when the sun went down at like 4 o'clock. And if we had a day scene that we ran out of light, we had to kind of be ruthless and say, well, here's a scene that takes place in front of a house, and looking out of the street, we have to do that in the daytime. Looking back at the front porch, we'll do that later and shoot at night for day.
Wow.
So, and that became a bit of a challenge, and also a bit of a feather in your cap to say, yeah, we've shot that all. People would look at a scene that has bright sunlight out the windows and say, that was done at 3 a.m. and it was raining. And, or snowing. And you say, well, it looks like a sunny day. Yeah, I know. That's the movie.
Wow. That's so amazing. Yeah, that must have been quite the learning experience, being like, oh, we have to shoot, you know, night for day. and just like,
yeah,
all of the movie magic tricks that have to happen to, you know, make schedules and make budgets. And, you know, The Brood was a relatively, you know, low budget film with a slim crew. What was it like working with a smaller group of people? You know, as someone who has the, you know, library that you do, do you like working with a smaller crew, or do you prefer a larger crew?
Well, in those days, the crew that I had was the crew that was kind of the norm. Right now, people have, right now meaning 2019, well into the 21st century, it's not uncommon to have three giant trucks, one for grip, one for camera, one for electric. In those days, we had grip and electric in one truck, which was a 5-ton, and a little box van for camera. It was one camera, and it was a film camera, so there was no Video Village.
Right.
So it was, by its own dimensions, by its own definition, a small crew. I never knew anything bigger. And at that point, I hadn't shot anywhere but in Toronto. I shot an enormous number of documentaries, and the crew in that case was me and a sound man, just me. So I would have to light a set, load the mags, shoot everything, operate, full focus. And that was the norm. So the baseline for me was getting, you know, shooting scenes on your hands and knees, and making it up as you went along. So to have a someone to push a dolly and someone that I could ride on, wow. And then someone to pull focus for me. You're kidding. You do that. Oh, yeah. So I had graduated from film school 5 years earlier. And at that point in my career, I'd really only done about 10 films. And so the small budget, small crew, and in many ways, a humble story. It was, it kind of expanded as we went, but it was really Art Hindle against the world, and Samantha Eggar and Oliver Reed were just the three points of that triangle. So it was a somewhat concise story, and a small crew was in some ways an advantage. There were not a lot of, certainly no green screen or visual effects, or there were prosthetic effects. And certainly when Samantha Eggar was giving birth to children on her lap, that was definitely part of the landscape that needed a special effect. But I don't know. I guess at that time, that was how many years ago?
40
years ago, 41 years ago, 78. We didn't know any better. And in Toronto, that was, and here's, I'll tell you a secret. All of us in Canada, certainly in English Canada, and having worked a lot in French Canada, the assumption was the same, even though it was a different language. And the assumption was that we have to do this better than best, the best we can, because that's how they do it in Hollywood. We got to aim for that standard. And once I moved to Hollywood, the first film I ever shot in Hollywood was called Hanoi Hilton in 1986. And it was, I realized the first day of shooting that they didn't have this and they forgot that. And we'll get that tomorrow. And maybe, and oh, I forgot about this. And I'm thinking, this is Hollywood.
Wow.
I'm here at the top of Mount Everest. And you guys are worse than we are in Toronto, because we all assumed you were aimed, your standards were higher. So in Toronto, you really got high quality cast and crew, because we were all aiming for something, I guess, that does exist, but it was a standard that was more mythical than actual.
Wow. Yeah, but it's funny how you realize, like, oh, you know, not everybody maybe is up to the standards that you're working towards. You know, it's kind of a revelation. But I want to go back to the special effects for a second, because obviously David Cronenberg's known for body horror and blood and more blood. The Brood, it does have its moments. It does have its, you know, weird, you know, fetuses and blood and the little broodettes running around. But it's not a particularly heavy special effects movie. What were your conversations with David like on how to shoot the special effects that were featured in it?
Because Felix and Johnny, the two little people who were the original kind of gangster broodlets who would walk around and capture people, they had, Jack Young had done this is a guy who'd done, you know, Apocalypse Now, and he was a Hollywood makeup artist.
Oh, yeah, he did The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, but his background was in that era, which was to say a lot of the Wizard of Oz, Oz effects were made with wax. And we were looking at these faces thinking, this doesn't look so good. I'm just sharing that with you. I don't want to, it's no denigration of Jack, who passed away with all his credits intact. We just had to start lighting these guys in a somewhat different way, and cutting away, so brief flashes of heads turning, shadows, hands reaching out, that sort of thing. The broodlets, when that scene where they're walking Cindy down the highway in the snow, a long lens thing, we decided to make them as a force rather than close-ups of their waxy face, I guess is what it is.
Yeah,
there was a scene in the autopsy room, which was at an actual hospital, and Jack brought out the body, they were autopsying or whatever, cutting up, and it was just a wax. It was like a candle.
Oh, so it's melting.
And these are the kind of scenes where, unlike creepy basements or attics or dark, steamy alleys, this was a examination room. So there had to be a light on it. The after effect, done in post, someone else decided, well, here's one thought, and let's make it all purple, which they did. So it kind of takes you away from the artificial look for it. The kids, the actual broodlets, who were kids in a gymnastics club,
right,
were all very enthusiastic. And this was my luck with my experience directing and shooting documentaries that I had done. My former partner was an editor, was also a member of the Canadian gymnastics team. So we did a lot of films about girls' gymnastics. And so I knew some of these kids and their trainers, and the kids were very enthusiastic. Jack, however, put these masks on them. We didn't have enough time and people to add wax applications to sculpt out the face. So he kind of glued these masks on. And with the Dr. Denton hood, it all became part of this apparition, especially when they attack Oliver Reed in their little bunkhouse.
Right.
So lots of shadows, lots of backlight, lots of top light and creepy shadows on their faces. It turned out, however, that in the morning, these little girls were athletic and up to running around. Their faces, the masks were glued on. When it's time for lunch, these masks won't come off.
Oh, no.
Without a fight. So it was like, well, just have to eat lunch with the mask on, which put them in a different kind of mood. And then in the afternoon, Oliver had to do this scene where he goes in the bunkhouse and they are all kind of hissing like serpents trying to attack him in the shadows. They were now afraid for many reasons. One, that Ollie was a bit demonstrative, a big human being,
right,
and these were little six-year-old girls. But he was, as usual, somewhat inebriated, and he smelled like alcohol. And these girls were supposed to jump on him and attack him. You know, it's all play. Let's have fun. They were not having any part of it.
Oh no!
So it turned out that we rearranged the room slightly, put all of their parents behind each bunk bed, hid them behind black cloth, which in the business is called duvetine. And when Ollie came close to them, Mom and Dad would push the kid, and they'd land on Ollie, and he would kind of grab them,
wow,
and splatter them on his face to make it look like they were attacking him. And he did this whole kind of dance with kids who were crying and screaming, "Get him away from me. I want to go home." And so that was chaos at its finest.
Wow.
And David was directing in all directions. But that's one of my most searing effects, memories of makeup. Samantha is covered with the ectopic,
what would you call them?
Placentas, I guess. Yeah, so she's giving birth to children on her skin, on her lap, and she kind of reveals the thing, and it's, oh my God, Art Hindle is agape. So we lit that in a very brooding way again, but these were nothing more than kind of jelly filled condoms and corn syrup,
yeah,
mixed with food coloring. So she was, and David, that was the second film I did with him, and his involvement, shall we say, the makeup girls would, he'd say, "More blood," and they'd get a little paintbrush and a little dab, dab, dab. No, "More blood, please." Dab, dab, dab. Finally said, "Give me that." And there was literally a bucket of blood. He put his hand in and whoosh, splash it all over. "More blood, more blood." So we had T-shirts made, white T-shirts with red blood splattered with the two words, "More blood!" Exclamation mark.
That's perfect. When
it came to Samantha, she was covered in the "more blood, more blood, more blood." And we shot all morning. It's time for lunch. And this corn syrup, which was essentially liquid sugar,
right,
had crystallized. And she turned into this gigantic candy apple.
Oh, no.
Could not move. it was like a candy statue stuck in the on the set. So it took like half an hour with warm water and towels to try to melt it and separate her. That was funny after the fact. At the time, not so much fun.
Wow. Those are some amazing stories, Mark. That's unbelievable. Because I always wondered, like, what was that goo that she's licking, you know? Because it's got to be, like, jelly or something.
It was
edible.
All high fructose corn syrup is what it was.
Perfect.
Delicious, yeah.
Now, let's talk about the autobiographical nature of this movie that you kind of mentioned in the beginning. This was a very personal film for David. Like you said, he had gone through a divorce and was battling, you know, for custody of his child. Do you think that this was kind of a therapeutic process for him to make this movie? And did he share anything of that nature with you?
Well, I knew David and Carolyn, his wife, and my wife, Pam, and I. We kind of got to know each other beyond the set, which is tends to be a little on a set. It's very militaristic, you know, people yelling orders over radios and we're back to work, you know, all that stuff. So in the quieter moments, we got to know each other better. And his tragic experience with his wife, his ex-wife, who literally kidnapped his daughter and took her to I won't call it a commune. I think it was more of a cult headquarters in Northern California.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't Scientology. I think it was EST or something like that. But she left the country. And this was back in 1970-something. It was before 1978. And you can't do this anymore. But he got on a plane, flew to Los Angeles, rented a car, drove to this compound, took his daughter, put her in the car, drove to the airport, and flew back to Canada.
Wow.
So, you know, two can play this game if you want to kidnap somebody. So the custody battle was played with he and his daughter from the north side of the border, not the southern side. And Cassandra was the inspiration for all of it. And Cass is now, you know, in her 40s and an artist and a wonderful person. And I'm sure she was not aware of the anguish. I mean, I've been divorced. I know how it affects everybody. But David was a no-nonsense guy, and I don't think this was just, might make an interesting story. It was like, I'm going to pour this all out into this screenplay.
Wow.
And Shivers and Rabid were not exactly easygoing movies, so he knew how to bite, and this was part of that. But I like the fact that David would always come up, I mean, all the films I did with him, excluding the Dead Zone, which he didn't really write as much, but Scanners and certainly Videodrome, these are all kind of scientific processes.
Yeah.
The Psychoplasmic Institute, and it reflects his past in getting a Bachelor of Science from the University of Toronto and end up making films.
That's right.
You don't just say, well, that was then, this is now, I'll make movies about superheroes.
Right.
I think he's unraveling himself on film. And this story was personal, but it went beyond, I got my daughter back. Now let's do a film about lawyers talking. Well, no, let's not do that. Let's pretend that this cult was going beyond teaching kids how to rethink their morality. And this is in body remorphication, if that's a word, you know, body changing as well as a mental change.
Right.
And David's ability to take a story and extrapolate it and say, what if, I mean, that was the core about Scanners. Thalidomide was something that as a birth, a drug that would address birth or pregnancy pain ended up having physical manifestations on the child that you could see, shortened limbs and missing limbs. Mm-hmm. This one was completely invisible. And so he would take something and expand it way beyond. And I think Psychoplasmics and his approach to, as he pointed out, a lot of what Samantha's character or Samantha herself reminded him of his ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And so you don't just say, well, what if you did this? It's like, I know what you would say because it's been said to me before.
Right.
So I really felt it for him. And I was at that point, 1978, I wasn't even married yet. To come to think, we got married in 1980. So it was always amazing to be at, as I kept telling people, we have front row seats here. This is history being made.
Yeah.
Some people would say, well, it's a 7 o'clock call. We'll work till 8:30. And then what are you doing the weekend? No, no, you're working with someone at this point who's just a filmmaker. Who knew working on The Killers that this little skinny Jewish photographer who's now a director in New York City was Stanley. That's Stanley Kubrick. Nobody knew in 1964, and we didn't know in 1978, but we do now. And looking back, these were vital moments. And looking over at David, as in those days there was no video village, so the director was next to the camera. And I would look at him and he would look at me. And we were conspiring dramatically, but also in a lot of ways, innovating. There hadn't been films like this. John Carpenter, there were a lot of guys who were parallel to him.
Right.
Wes Craven was a little more cryptic, but David was really reaching into human stories and saying, what if this happened? I mean, Videodrome was about based on City TV, which was the first cable TV studio, I should say network, in the world, and it was in Toronto. And he said, well, what if there was a TV show that was so depraved that everyone who watched it had a brain tumor and died, and they were targeting these people? And that's when, you know, a filmmaker and a brilliant filmmaker, that was when the distinction is made. So The Brood was part of that, to take a personal story. It wasn't like, what if? It was like, I know what I want to say.
Right.
And you are going to say it and point to the actor or actress and say, you ready? And action. So he was a writer first and then a filmmaker, and extremely good at both.
And what a different level of filmmaking that you and David gave the world. I mean, it's so cerebral, you know, it's on a different level. You're right. He comes from a scientific background. He's interested in portraying these very human stories, but taking them to the extreme, or just, you know, a different, strange, parallel world. There's just something very, very special and very smart about the films that you guys made together. And I'm in awe of the work. I mean, we're 40 years, you know, since The Brood, and here we are talking about it still. And Mark, I got to ask you, like, you know, you've done so many movies in the horror genre, so many movies, you know, in the comedy realm. Is there a difference between, like, shooting a movie like Dumb and Dumber and shooting a Cronenberg film? Is there really, are they very different animals? How do you approach each of
them? Well, here's something that you and your listeners will not immediately understand. The hardest films to make are comedies. Making people laugh is extremely hard. Making a lot of people laugh is extremely hard. And Something About Mary was kind of the perfect storm of all these elements that made it successful. The easiest films to shoot, in many ways, are horror films. And having done Scream and Vampire in Brooklyn and New Nightmare, there are kind of conventions, things that go bump in the night. There's ways to shock people and scare them. And there's a formulaic foundation that people say, well, let's do this. And you do it and you think, well, this feels familiar because I've done it before. I mean, I've done big action films with Brandon Lee and Dolph Lundgren and Jackie Chan. And those are the easiest ones of all. That is true formula. Kick somebody in the head, crash cars, blow up stuff, shoot people, and they fall off the building. But getting inside people's minds and getting inside their inner fears and making something successful out of that story, that was where David, I feel, and having worked with Chuck Russell, who did The Blob, and Wes, who did Scream, they were more analytical, and David was much more cerebral, much more emotional. And to look at David, he when I worked with him, he was this young guy who wore a motorcycle jacket all the time because he rode his motorcycle to work all the time. And he had a very, very wide-eyed, young, innocent kind of demeanor. But inside, you know, the still waters run deep kind of metaphor that he was a lot turning around. And someone, I think it was John Landis, pointed out he looked like a Beverly Hills gynecologist. And So he's a sweet kind of soft-edged person, and he makes these, and they're not bloodthirsty movies. That's the thing. I mean, Videodrome, The Dead Zone, for sure. When we did The Dead Zone, I talked to him. We had, you know, the talk with the DP and the director. What is the look of the film? And he said he didn't want to talk about it. Just make it look like Norman Rockwell shot it. Mm. End of discussion. So it was Americana. The Brood was a different story. Scanners was a different story. Let's explore the dark parts of pharmacological business. And that's where he was happy to go to explore it instead of saying, well, here's another scene where something goes crash and somebody digs a knife into somebody and we do this. Been there, done that. I want to go somewhere else. And David's never gone, repeated anything. Existence and Eastern Promises. These are movies that other people not only didn't do, but were never going to do. Mm. And he was not afraid. I'm going to go there. Crash. Let's do that. Let's examine body disfiguration. Let's examine the scientific aspects of people's lives. Or let's predict the future. And it's funny to think that Videodrome predicted the future as giant libraries of VHS cassettes.
Right.
Saying, here, let's watch that. Press a button on a hard drive. No, it has to be a tape. Who would ever, how, that would never work. A telephone that will play movies? Impossible. Well, it happened, David. So I guess the remake, if there ever is a remake or a reboot of Videodrome, will be more exciting and probably more boring.
Right.
Here we are.
Yeah, it's
click
happened.
Click and drag, next. But yeah, David was not, I think about him was that he was never afraid of anything. Mm-hmm. And I remember shooting the Dead Zone, and we were seen with Jackie Burroughs playing Johnny's, Chris Walken's mother, who passes away in the hospital, and we angle after angle. It's 1 a.m, 2 and 3 a.m. And the producer and the AD are nudging me, saying, what does he want? What does he want? In other words, when are we going to go home? When are we going to get off the clock? So I finally said, David, what do you want? Meaning coverage-wise. And he kind of took it as a grander, more existential question. What do I want?
Oh, geez.
They looked at me and said, he said, I want it all. And I think he's got it all.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't afraid. And he said, that's what's going to happen. That's what I want. That's what we're going to do. Have we done it yet? No. Let's keep going until we've got it.
Wow.
And that's the man.
The fearlessness is something to be admired. It really is. And they really were groundbreaking stories that you and David brought to life. I've just got one more question for you, Mark. And
Sure. That's
an extra credit question that I ask everyone who comes on the show. And it's, if you could go back in time 40 years ago, what advice would you give yourself?
I'll rewind the clock to 1978 in Toronto, and I had been exploring myself. Because in those days, we would shoot industrial films and educational films and sponsored films and then a feature and then a low-budget after-school special with kids. So the world, through my viewfinder, was constantly changing, and that the only advice I would give myself then was do more of everything, because that's the world. As your mind expands, a lot of people, and that's what the film business has come now in Toronto, become now in Toronto and Vancouver. I call it the lunchbox cities, because people just go to work and they're working on Star Trek, but it's just punching the clock and a daily this and a daily that, and the involvement that's the potential to create and to go beyond with director and cinematographer and production designer, that threesome to break barriers and you know, break new ground. I wish that's what I would have told myself then, to take yourself out of the convention and experiment. And I, in many ways, I was, and we were experimenting, because the stories and the method of presenting the scenes, we would study other films and say, well, that worked, but I want to try it this way. And the inspirations would start compounding, and this giant pyramid of inspiration would go higher and higher, and then the base itself would become broader and broader. So it's an intriguing question to say what advice would you give yourself then. But I guess I would say now, I'm glad you kept doing all those films you did. I remember shooting an industrial film for a meatpacking company called Canada Packers. And seeing all the stuff I saw in these slaughterhouses ended up being part of the set design on Videodrome.
Oh, wow.
Years later. So your brain retains all this information, visual and otherwise, and says, you know what? This is good. Let's suggest that. And so the broader horizons that you aim for, instead of the repetitive lunchbox thing, working Monday to Friday on this show, that to me is the liberating aspect of filmmaking.
Diversify and, you know, don't be afraid to try new things. And I think you and David, your projects together, you know, should be a beacon to everyone to push the envelope and try other things and see where your mind can take you. But this has been such a great conversation, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us today to share your memories of making The Brood. And we just, you know, we love your work here at Fangoria. Like David Cronenberg's movies, his early ones, would have, you know, not been the same without you. I think you and he were such a great team. So thank you for everything you've given us. And I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Well, thank you very much for that. That was a very inspiring wrap up there, and I hope we can talk again in the future.
That's Raglan. That's psychoplasmics. It's called lymphosarcoma, and it's spreading.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 79. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love it if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 79 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pasetta, executive producers Dallas Sonier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavimer, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pasetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynerdy, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.